Well, what we've been discussing over the last few weeks has been the growing complexity of the creeds of the early church. And by creeds, I mean what it is that the church believed. The church could no longer afford the luxury of simplicity. To remain faithful to the truth that she had been entrusted with against the slander of pagans and of the various heresies that were out there, that meant that she must clearly define what that truth was, what that truth was that she believed. So the process of definition began to explicitly define the complexities of the faith in order to protect the simple venerations of the heart, that the church might know the true Christ in order to worship the Christ that she truly knows. That's what the purpose was. Well, as his doctrinal activity then intensified, it began to coalesce into the two schools of thought that we studied last week. And they were reflective of the two primary cultures of the ancient world, of course, Greek and of Rome. They had the same Catholic faith, the same fundamentals, but with distinctly different perspectives of those fundamentals. Each of those perspectives would supply unique contributions, as well as infect the church with unique mistakes. Men such as Origen and Tertullian that we talked about last week represented both the brilliance of these schools as well as the danger that a culture can have upon the perception of the gospel. I might point out, however, that because this was uncharted territory for these men, history has been kinder to their mistakes than it should ever be to those who came after them. We have been put on notice by the mistakes that they made to beware of how our culture can distort the gospel. We have no excuse. Now, a final word on last week. We should understand that the excesses, the mistakes that Origen, Tertullian made are they don't indicate the actual theology of these two schools. They represent the poles, that is, they are the extremes. In reality, the Alexandrian and Latin schools are much closer to the center. Okay? They don't represent divergent theologies that were competing against each other. They were actually different emphasis on a different focal point on the same Catholic faith. Okay? So the Greek mind began to focus upon the nature of God, began to look at those types of issues. Whereas the Latin mind, which was far more practical, began to look at things like the nature of man and the nature of salvation. So different perspectives on the same Catholic faith, okay? Now this morning, what we're going to look at, a second evolution. The same forces that caused the evolution of theology brought about a change in church polity. The word polity simply means government. We get, of course, the word politics from it. And just like politics, the history of church government is a very controversial subject. That's because the debate is not simply about the form of church government, but the inherent authority that each form of government represents. Okay, who are you going to invest this authority to? That's the question behind the questions of church government. So this morning we're going to examine church polity from the beginnings of the church to the end of the Ante-Nicene age. What form of government did the early church have, or can we even tell? And if it is different at the end of the age than when it began, how and why did it change? Those are the questions we're going to ask. So we have to begin with the apostolic church. The original polity, the original government of the church, was a carryover from Jesus' own ministry. That is, you had the 12 apostles that he chose, minus the one who had betrayed him. And the church's very first political act was filling the empty office that Judas left behind. If we read very closely, we can see that the qualifications for the office of apostle were uniquely tied to that generation and that generation alone. Notice the condition required to fill Judas's office in Acts chapter 1, verse 21. Therefore, of these men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning from the baptism of John to that day when he was taken up from us, one of these men must become a witness with us of his resurrection. Notice then that the only candidates for the office of apostle were those who had been eyewitnesses to the ministry and resurrection of Christ, from the baptism of John to his ascension. Not only does that preclude the continuation of the office of apostle today, but it would have been very restricting even in that day. A very limited number of candidates here. So it's no wonder that the church initially questioned Paul's apostleship. Yet even Paul understood this requirement. Notice how he answered his critics. He said, "Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord?" Later in that same letter, he says that Christ had been seen by all the apostles, and then last of all, he was seen by me also as one born out of due time. So the necessity then of being a personal witness to the risen Christ was an integral part of the office of apostle. Now, because of that requirement, even apostles could not generate new apostles. Nor could they be in all places. They could not be in all churches. So what form of government did they establish in the eventuality of their own absence? Now that's a difficult question because there's not a lot of detail in the New Testament about that issue. The Scripture is far more concerned about describing the moral character of those in church government than in the government itself. However, it does seem clear and it is widely accepted that the New Testament churches were patterned after the Jewish synagogue. And that only makes sense. Most of the early converts were Hellenistic Jews, familiar with the model of the synagogue. In fact, the area there in Galilee, those people were considered to be Hellenistic Jews. So the most of the apostles were what they called Hellenistic Jews. They were very familiar with the synagogue. And Christ taught at the synagogues. Paul taught at the synagogues. So there's an unspoken affirmation that the synagogue pattern was an acceptable model of worship and instruction. We find similarities between the church and the synagogue in her liturgy, in her manner of teaching, and in the language that is used to describe her governmental offices. And so that's going to give us insight into the way these offices were arranged. We know that the synagogue was governed by a council. Acts chapter 13, verse 15 calls them the rulers of the synagogue. They determined who was to read, who was to conduct prayers, and who it was going to address the people. And I don't believe it's a coincidence that the qualifications for that office within the synagogue, are very similar to Paul's instructions to Timothy on the qualifications of elders and deacons. When we compare them side by side, they are very, very similar. So Paul was probably drawing upon that familiar model of leadership when he wrote his letter to Timothy. So then what was the pattern for the polity of the New Testament church? Well, all evidence points to the ruling council of elders, just as you had within the synagogue. Along with the elders, the church established deacons. The Greek word for deacon actually means an attendant. It's someone who serves. It's a helper. And that role is very clear when the office is first established in the 6th chapter of Acts. The apostles there speaking in verse 2 said, "It is not desirable that we should leave the word of God and serve tables." The apostles apparently serving tables. "Therefore seek out from among you 7 men of good reputation whom we may appoint over this business." So the office of deacon is that of a worker. It carried no connotation of teaching or of authority. Originally, it was not a part of the clergy. Of course, the word clergy comes from the use there in the Septuagint, where they used it for the word Levite. So it's not part of the clergy. That's why there's no conflict between Paul and the fact that there were female deacons, because they were servants. They were not teachers. They did not hold authority. Okay? The original role of the deacons was to manage the charitable functions of the church, the serving of the poor and the care of widows. If you'll notice there in the text, they were both chosen by the congregation and they were appointed by the apostles. And so that leads to one of the most difficult questions. We see here that the congregation is participating in appointing the office of deacon. That leads to the question, what role did the congregation play in the appointment of elders, if any? Well, Calvin believed that the congregation chose elders in the same way they chose deacons, but that opinion was colored by a faulty translation of Acts 14. In verse 23, Scripture says that Paul and Barnabas appointed elders in every church, and the Greek word that is translated there, appointed, originally meant a show of hands. So Calvin took this to be an open election. But modern research has shown that by the time of the New Testament, that word was also used of the laying on of hands, not just a show of hands. So the word itself could support either view, a congregational election or an apostolic appointment. But I think it is clear from the context that this was more of an ordination, not a popular election. Okay? However, I do think there is historical evidence to believe that there are aspects of both in this. There is a nomination as well as an acceptance. And once again, the synagogue model provides some insight, as does the history of the church during the second and third centuries. In the synagogue, the elders were nominated by popular voice, but they were then also designated by the laying on of hands by at least three other ordained elders. So there's a nomination process by the people, but there's an ordination process by the other elders. Church history gives us examples of this very same practice. Some of the most prominent bishops in the early church were elected by popular demand, but they also had to be confirmed by clergy as well. Cyprian, Augustine, and Ambrose were all elected in that fashion. So if we do a little speculation here, it seems that there were times when the apostles or their representatives nominated candidates who they believed were qualified, and then the congregation approved or accepted them. While in other cases, the congregation did the nominating and the apostles or the clergy did the confirming, either direction. Cyprian, who was the most prominent bishop of the Ante-Nicene age, said that it was of divine authority that the priest be chosen in the presence of the people and be approved as worthy and fit by public testimony and judgment. Even earlier, Clement of Rome expressly wrote that the consent of the congregation was a criteria for a valid election of elders. So it looks like, basically, you have those that are in the clergy nominating someone who they believe is a proper candidate, and then basically presenting them to the congregation and saying, is there any reason that any of you might know that this man is not qualified to hold this office? Okay? So for these reasons, I believe the polity that we've been describing here is actually closest to the Presbyterian form of government that came out of the Reformation. Existing elders set out the qualifications, just as Paul had done to Timothy. The people then nominated candidates, just as they had at the first election of deacons. The elders then examined those candidates. They approved those who were, and then presented them to the entire body for their consent. And that's very much what we see in the synagogue and in the early years of the church. But we need to be very careful not to inject American ideas of democracy into this process. This was less about expressing individual choices as it was in building unity through consensus. There's a mutual bond here between congregation and leadership. The people trust that their elders will present them with men worthy of their acceptance. And the elders expect their congregations to recognize this, to honor this, and unless there are some mitigating circumstance, to accept the candidates that they offer. Okay? But one thing is without question and is beyond speculation. However an elder or a presbyter was put into office, whatever kind of voting there may have been, it ceased once they were put into that office. There were never referendums on doctrine or on discipline. Popular vote could never remove an elder from office. He did not serve at the pleasure of his congregation, that they might scratch their itching ears. Okay? You have nothing but chaos in that situation. When the congregation stops liking what you're preaching, They should not have the authority to kick you out. Because the gospel, the true gospel, is a hard message. Okay? Now, the reason why this is important is because during the next 200 years, all of this would change. Church polity in the patristic age would settle into the familiar threefold ministry of bishop, presbyter, and deacon. And it further grew from having local bishops to metropolitan bishops, and then into the patriarchal system that eventually gave us the papacy. What is important to see here is that the claims of the Roman Catholic Church, and even of some Anglicans, that their hierarchy, the papacy, and all of that is a divine right that originated with the apostles, that is simply untrue. It is not borne out by history. Now, one might argue that this form of government became a necessity, but you cannot claim that it was apostolic, because it wasn't. Okay? So, with this change then, we need to ask the question, what forced this transition? What made it change? What necessity did the church see that prompted it to move in this direction? Well, the book of Acts describes the earliest church as being of one heart and soul. But as the dangers of heresy and of division grew, I believe church polity began to consolidate as a reaction to that. Remember that the second century was a chaotic period in the church's history. Persecutions and heresies both tended to drive the churches inward. It is an interesting footnote that in this same period, the heretical Ebionite churches also moved in the same direction, independent of the Catholic churches. So it appears that the influence of the times, this chaotic period, was it tended to force the churches to consolidate and to centralize. Okay? And nothing illustrates that better than the rise of the office of bishop. In the New Testament, the office of elder and bishop were one and the same. The term presbyteros, which is where we get the word presbyter or elder from, and the term episkopos, I'm sorry, I should not have hit that, we get the word bishop from, they were interchangeable. Presbyter and bishop referred to the same person in the same office. Episcopus came from two Greek words that meant overseer or overwatcher. That's literally what it meant. Whereas presbyter literally meant old man. It came to mean an elder. Remember, in ancient times, age and experience were respected commodities. Those who oversaw those who were immature were the older men, the elders. So you can see how these two terms were synonymous. Even the ruling members of the synagogue were referred to as both elders and overseers, presbyters and bishops, we might say. So Pastor Jack is a presbyter and he is a bishop in the New Testament sense. Now, that begins to change in the second century. And as I said, the only way to adequately explain it is by human necessity. Really, there's nothing sinister about it. There's no grasp for power here. And it doesn't happen overnight. We can almost see the transition when we look at the early writings of the church fathers. Remember Clement of Rome, who wrote to the Corinthians after their church had split. And in his letter, he is still using the terms presbyter and bishop interchangeably. He consistently is referring to just two offices, not three. In one passage, he says bishops and deacons. In the next, it's presbyters and deacons. In fact, he urges the Corinthians to submit to the presbyters. He doesn't even mention bishops in that passage. And Clement's position is intriguing in itself because of his role in the Roman church. Remember, the letter was written in the name of the Roman congregation, not on behalf of bishops or elders, or even in the name of Clement himself. So we can still see here in Clement's letter the original simplicity of the church's government. And there is some interesting conjecture that we can make here as well. Rome says that the first three popes were Clement, Linus, and Anacletus. But there's confusion in the order. In some lists, Clement is the first pope, that is, after they say Peter. In other lists, he's second or third. They're kind of mixed up in there. So why the confusion? Can our look at church polity here give us a reasonable explanation for why these names are jumbled up and confused in various lists? And I think it can. As we've seen in Clement's day, presbyters and bishops were one and the same. And if Clement, Linus, and Anacletus were in fact bishops in the New Testament sense, that is, they belong to one council of ruling elders, that would give you three bishops at the same time. So when the lists of bishops were then put together centuries later, at a time when the church was now using a single bishop, what do you do with these three names? You try to put them in some kind of order. And so the confusion comes in the fact that people putting these lists together were not putting them in the same order. They were taking three equal elders and trying to put one or the other at the top of the list. So Clement here makes no distinction between bishops and presbyters. Neither does Polycarp. They are just different titles for the same office. The first appearance of a separation between bishops and presbyters is with Ignatius. We talked about Ignatius before. A lot of controversy about Ignatius. Think about some of the positions that are attributed to Ignatius. That the human bishop is the center of unity for the single congregation and holds the office vicariously for Christ and even God. That doing anything without the knowledge of the bishop is serving the devil. That the people must unconditionally obey the bishop and do nothing without his will. That apostasy from the bishop is apostasy from Christ, who acts in and through the bishop as his organ. Well, there is no way to believe that these positions represent the existing church government of that day. You will not find that kind of language again in the church for over 300 years, not until Leo I makes salvation dependent upon obedience to the Pope. It is simply too anachronistic to be authentic. It doesn't compare to the position of his contemporaries, nor to other sources, especially the New Testament. As I said before, it would be similar to Abraham Lincoln referring to affirmative action. It's out of place. Okay? So thankfully, a lot of the extreme language that is in these writings of Ignatius in favor of elevating these bishops has been proven by modern scholarship to be forgeries. They're not authentic. They were added later. However, historians still believe that the real Ignatius does represent the beginnings of a shift in the church's government, in that he focused on the office of bishop as distinct or separate from that of an elder. And obviously we know that the church did end up breaking these two into separate offices. So we still have to ask the question, how did this happen? Why did it happen? And it appears that what Ignatius represents is an exaggeration of a distinction that went back to this continuing model of the synagogue. You remember that the rulers of the synagogue equated to the elders of the church. That's the model that was used. Well, in the synagogue, the ruling council elected a president from their members. And his role would be similar to that of a committee chairman or board of directors. Okay, he moderated the council. He kept the council functioning. He had a preeminence of honor, but not a preeminence of authority. He was still just an elder. Okay, his voice or his vote didn't count for any more than any other elder on this board. And we find this practice modeled in some of the early churches as well. We know that the practice of the church at Alexandria from the time of St. Mark down to the 3rd century was that these 12 presbyters or elders would elect one of their own as the president of the council. And interestingly enough, they referred to him as bishop instead of presbyter. So the first distinction we find between presbyter and bishop is a distinction of title, not of authority. He's not elevated above the rest of the council in authority. But he is given a separate office, a separate function, as you would the president of a board. Okay? But as the second century unfolded, this slight distinction between these two types of elders began to separate into completely separate hierarchy of offices with completely different amounts of authority. We've already mentioned the tendency of the churches to consolidate power because of these external threats. But there was a practical reason for the elevation of the president or bishop as well. Every church in that day doubled as a charitable society. A lot of wealth in the form of food, clothing, even property passed through the churches. And the care of widows and orphans was considered to be a sacred trust. And so the administration of that was very important to the church. And in Greek communities, the term bishop or episcopus was the common term used for financial officers. So it is not unlikely that some transfer of that connotation passed into the church, as it was these people who began to handle the charitable funds. Okay? So that brought the chief elder then of the church into a close relationship with the deacons who distributed the funds. They would have had more contact then with the congregation. They would have had more contact with other clergy. They were probably already the most learned and the most eminent of the elders. That's why they were elected to this office. So it was only natural to begin to elevate them. And again, there's nothing sinister here. It's just a natural accumulation of authority. He's given more and more responsibilities. Now, this doesn't happen all at once, nor at the same pace. It probably occurred sooner in churches that retained a Jewish flavor, as we saw in Alexandria, because they would have seen a parallel in the Old Testament to the government there of high priest, priest, and Levite. Only now they have changed it to bishop, presbyter, and deacon. So they believed they saw a threefold office in the Old Testament. They began to model a threefold office in their own churches. So it's probable that the transition was faster in the East than it was in the West. By the time of Ignatius, who remember wrote from the East, we see the separation of the bishop and presbyters was probably still in its infancy and of fairly recent development. But Ignatius is urging its adoption. There's simply no way to interpret Ignatius as arguing from an existing policy. Why would he need to argue for something that already existed? Here he's trying to make a change. When he is saying, look now to your bishop, and separating that office from elder, he's trying to make a change. Okay? And the change takes place. With the explosion of Gnosticism and the threat that the churches were going to crumble because of all of these threats, the change in government probably spread quite rapidly as a means of protecting the churches. Remember that even in secular government, chaos always lends itself to the establishment of a strong central government. And this was a time of chaos and uncertainty for the church. Okay? Now in the West, a few decades later, Irenaeus seems to be right at that transition point. He is functioning now as a bishop. And he stresses the apostolic succession of teaching that is represented by the bishops. But he still makes very little distinction between presbyters and episcopus, that is, bishops. In fact, in one case, he says that the job of a presbyter is to oversee the flock. And the word he uses for oversee is the word for bishop. So he is basically saying that the job of the presbyter is to be a bishop. He even refers to the Bishop of Rome as a presbyter. So the transition is not yet complete with Irenaeus, but it is inevitable. It is moving that direction. So that by the middle of the next century, the threefold ministry of bishop, presbyter, and deacon has become the common polity of the church. That is the common church government, those three offices. So we see that the church went from a primitive somewhat Presbyterian form of government to a primitive episcopal type of government. Now understand that is still a long way from the Roman Catholic form of government. If anything, what the papacy and its hierarchy represent is the corruption of this transition, not the transition itself. As evidence to back up the scenario that was just given here, let me cite Jerome. Jerome lived very close to the Ante-Nicene age, and he wrote this about the government of the church. He wrote that the churches were originally governed by the common council of presbyters. But as divisions arose through the instigation of Satan, one of the presbyters was placed at the head to watch over the church and suppress schisms. And that's pretty much what I've tried to show here. That out of necessity, as they meant to try to protect the church, they tried to consolidate power in a single office to strengthen the church's government and authority by electing one of these elders into the office of chief elder, which would become the bishop. Okay? Any questions over any of that or comments? No? Okay. Now, the last thing I want to look at is the rise of the Roman bishop in particular. One of the most exhaustive looks at the early Roman popes has come to the following conclusion. In its earliest years, the Roman church, as we said, was co-ruled by more than one presbyter, as we saw with Linus, Anacletus, and Clement. There is a council of elders. Then, starting around the year 118, a single presbyter began to be elected as the chief elder, just as Jerome had just, as I read his quote. That office then evolved into what could be called a bishop around the year 139. Now, to understand the rise of the Roman bishop, you have to understand that the prominence that he took on was a carryover of the early prominence of the church at Rome itself. The Roman church had always been held in high esteem in the West. I think I've got these in, out of order, no? First of all, the church at Rome was the only apostolic church that was in the West. So all the Western churches looked upon it with a certain reverence. Although it wasn't founded by an apostle, this is where both Peter and Paul were believed to have met their deaths, and where both of them were buried. Not to mention that Paul's greatest epistle had been written to this church. So it had prominence because of that. Secondly, its history of martyrdom and persecutions dating back to Nero gave it, as one writer put it, a halo of glory rising from the graves of its victims. In a sense, the Colosseum then represented hallowed ground, like some kind of battlefield for the church where the soldiers of Christ were being slain. So there was a certain veneration there. Third, Rome was the capital of the ancient world. And so as Christianity grew, the Roman church's rank and position, along with its wealth and its natural influence, seemed to grow in proportion. It became just natural that the most powerful church was at the most powerful city in the empire. Okay? So the Roman church itself had a preeminence in the eyes of others. Irenaeus called Rome the greatest of the churches and gave her a precedence of honor. So you can see the growing influence of the Roman bishops. It was rooted in the public opinion of Rome itself. And it was certainly not because of the talents of these early popes. Except for Clement, the only remarkable thing about the first 30 popes is just how unremarkable they actually were. Not a single one of them compares to an Irenaeus or to a Polycarp as a church leader or as a theologian. Every one of these, all 30 of these people, are eminently forgettable. Every one of them. But as the church began to elevate the office of bishop, the preeminence of that particular church became attached to that office, so that no matter how unexceptional a bishop of Rome might be, he still carried the preeminence of Rome itself and of his office. So that meant an exceptional amount of power was now in the hands of very unexceptional men. And so with the consolidation of power around a single office, there was then the opportunity for abuse. Power corrupts, just as the phrase goes. The first expression of the growing claims of Roman superiority were around the year 190, where the Roman bishop Victor excommunicated every church in the East. He excommunicated every Christian in Asia Minor. And what heinous crime had these people committed? They were not celebrating Easter on a Sunday. That's why he excommunicated them. This split was known as a Quarta Decimanian controversy, which means 14th-ism. That's what that word means. And the reason it came about was that the Apostle John had taught the Eastern churches to celebrate the death of Christ on the Jewish Passover, which always fell on the 14th of the month, regardless of what day of the week it was. And Victor here was demanding that the Eastern churches celebrate the resurrection of Christ on a Sunday, regardless of the day of the month. That was the Roman practice. So you can see they're looking at two different aspects of Christ's passion here. The Eastern churches were commemorating his death. The Western churches were commemorating his resurrection. So they weren't celebrating this on the same day. Okay? And so Victor is now saying, you're excommunicated if you don't practice it like Rome practices it. All right? And so, as he excommunicates the Eastern churches, then the response that comes back to him shows us that they weren't accepting his claims of authority. The bishop of Ephesus wrote on behalf of those Eastern churches, and he cited his own apostolic heritage. It's kind of like saying, well, who are you? What is your lineage? I can point to Polycarp, who taught us this. And Polycarp was taught it by John. Who taught you? That's basically what he says. He ended the letter saying this: I am not at all alarmed at those things with which I am threatened by you to intimidate me. For they who are greater than I have said we ought to obey God rather than man. Okay? Well, Irenaeus' response to this whole controversy is interesting because up to this point, Irenaeus had always given Rome a measure of honor, a greater measure of honor. But he obviously never meant it to be a measure of superiority because Irenaeus then wrote Victor a very nasty letter. And he complained of this unheard of arrogant attitude. But this is the pattern that we find throughout all of this period, that the other bishops would give the Roman church a special honor due to her place in the empire until she finally began to believe it and then to claim it as a divine right. And so the other churches then are offended, even though they are the ones who were helping to create this monster by giving them this special honor and preeminence. The best example of this is the Bishop Cyprian. Cyprian actually provides the doctrinal basis for planting the seeds of the papacy, and he lived to regret it. Cyprian was elected by popular vote in the city of Carthage, even over his own protests. He didn't want to be bishop, but they said, you're going to be bishop. Once he was installed into that office, he was a vigorous churchman. He believed in that office of bishop. He was of the Latin school that we talked about last week, which was very judicial. It was influenced primarily by lawyers. And prior to his conversion, Cyprian had been a local government official. And once he became bishop, he changed the office by bringing to it his background in government and bureaucracy. And so this magisterial style of church government marked the beginning of the so-called curial bishops that would later become the hallmark of Roman Catholicism. He's laying that groundwork. And it was Cyprian who first transferred the supposed superiority of Peter to the Bishop of Rome as his successor. It's Cyprian who first says that. that Peter was over all the other apostles, and that has been passed on to the bishop at Rome. And so we have to ask the question, why would a bishop of Carthage in another city do such a thing? Why would he place that honor in this bishop of Rome? And again, it had to do with preserving unity, although in this case it was a rather self-serving and pragmatic approach. Cyprian was under tremendous pressure at home. His church had split. His own authority was in question. Among other things, a rival presbyter named Novatus had started his own church and was attracting people away from Cyprian's church with a more lenient doctrine of discipline. Novatus was saying, Cyprian's too hard on you. Come to my church and you'll have it easier. Okay? So what is Cyprian to do? The only recourse he had was to emphasize the divine authority of his own office, that of the bishop. And so he said this. He said, the bishop is in the church is in the bishop. And if any is not with the bishop, he is not in the church. You cannot have God for your father unless you have the church for your mother. Okay? Now, still, that wasn't enough. I mean, Cyprian could say that all he wanted. What he needed was outside support for that view. So Cyprian asked for help from the Church of Rome, and the Roman bishop gave it. But unless the Roman bishop then carried some kind of special weight, well, who cared? Novatus could get supporters as well. So what Cyprian did was to play up the preeminence of Rome as a unique office in order to bolster his own position over Novatus. He's saying, no matter what support Novatus can get, I have the bishop at Rome. And this is why he is more special than any other bishop. Okay? But Cyprian got more than he bargained for. After the crisis was over and a new pope had been elected, the Roman bishops then began to act out Cyprian's doctrine. They believed it. If Rome was the mother of the church and the church was in the bishop, then the Roman bishop was the church. That was the logic. And so when Pope Stephen began acting that policy out and dictating to the other churches, Cyprian realized his error. He became downright Protestant. He accused this pope of abusing his power and accusing him of errors in theology. And he gave us the quote that's on the back of our own church's newsletter, in which it says, tradition without truth is nothing but time-honored error. That's one of the great things about Cyprian. He supplies a lot of ammunition during the Reformation against the papacy. Because, as I said, he becomes downright Protestant. But Pandora's box had already been opened, and he wasn't going to get it shut. Within 30 years or so, Hippolytus, who was a student of Irenaeus, complained that the Roman popes were demanding absolute power within their own jurisdiction, and they would eventually claim absolute power over all of Christianity, and that gives us the papacy. And so we see here that by this time, the separation of a single bishop over the presbyters was now complete. They were separate offices. And it wasn't long before the subjugation of the elders was also complete. It soon became church law that a bishop could never be removed from office by elders, even though that bishop had committed gross sin. So what began in a time of crisis as a desire to unify the church under the protection of a single, strong, central voice representing genuine apostolic truth would be corrupted by ambition, it would eventually give us the papacy. It would take several centuries, but the foundations were here already laid for what Luther would call the Babylonian captivity of the church under the papacy. Okay? Any questions over any of that material?
I have a question. When did the calling of a Catholic church turn into Roman Catholic Church?
Well, actually, as far as just the title, that's actually after the Reformation. Because what happens is that the Anglican Church calls itself Catholic as well. So then they begin to call Roman Catholic Church to differentiate between the Anglican Church. So that's actually later.
I have another comment.
Right down where I turn on the street to go to my house, there's a huge lot been empty for a long time. And they fenced it all in, and now there's this huge sign. It says Mary's Catholic Church. Now, why did they negate Roman Catholic Church? Because that's what it is.
Well, yeah, but the Roman Catholic Church, you usually don't see Roman on there. They believe they are the Catholic Church. Now, we use the shorthand Roman, like I said, to differentiate between particularly Anglicans. But for them, a lot of times you'll see on their churches, it's Holy Catholic Church, as if there is no other. Okay, I mean, that's their claim. Okay, anything else? So the thing we've got to remember about any form of government, especially even church government, is it's only as good as the integrity of those in office. Really, when you look at it, the best form of government is a benevolent dictatorship. I mean, that's what the kingdom of heaven is. Problem is finding among fallen men a benevolent dictator. There's not many of them. And once they, even if they begin that way, they're soon corrupted by all that power. Okay? It really goes back to the integrity of the office. And even pure democracy, I mean, that's the worst form of government is pure democracy. You have nothing but chaos, where every person out there, every citizen out there has the same vote and voice in making policy. So just like in the foundation of our country and its government, where it's a representative form of government, they took that model from the Presbyterian form of government of the church after the Reformation, saying that there should be a plurality of elders who have this authority, okay, that they don't lord it over the people that they are governing, right? But there are some checks and balances by that form of government that you don't have when you have just a single office of bishop, or the chaos of all the congregation deciding what we're going to preach today. Okay? Yeah.
Yeah, Steve, how does the Episcopal Church address their structure of their government with bishops in a regional and more national representation in this history that the church has, well, the Catholic Church had followed?
Well, the Episcopal Church, of course, being a form of Anglicanism, the Anglicans modeled their church somewhat after the Roman Catholic Church, and they still have that threefold ministry, that threefold office. And you'll get them to admit that that wasn't, or you'll get some of them to admit that that wasn't the original pattern, but they will say that it is, without question, that within the first couple of centuries, that is the pattern throughout all the churches, and that is true. Now, kind of depends. The Episcopal Church is kind of a mixed bag, because you have some of them that are they're neo-Catholic. I mean, they're right on the border of being Roman Catholic, and then you have others that are somewhat they have an affinity sort of. They're certainly not Presbyterian, but they're not nearly as high church as those that are closer to the Roman Catholic Church. So there's definitely a mixed bag across there. But they still, most of them, will still say that there is an apostolic succession through the bishops, just like you have in Roman Catholicism. Even some of those that aren't so high church will still claim that that office of bishop for that particular area, they trace it back all the way through history to some apostle.
But I guess the structure itself is not inherently flawed. It's just the abuse of that structure.
Yes, it's just the... And again, that's what I was trying to get across. That this originally wasn't any kind of a power grab, that it was out of necessity. It makes for a stronger form of government that you can have unity. Okay, it takes away the looseness, which is always... the church was threatened because of the persecutions, the pressures externally, and then also the heresies. So it's threatening to split everything apart. And what they did was then unify that under a single strong voice. As long as that person in that office is a man of integrity, which many of them, most of them were at that time in those early years, then there's not a problem. But once you invest all that authority into that office, then when somebody sees the power that goes with that, they then have the ambition to take that office for their own gain. And that's what we begin to see as the years pass, as the centuries pass. People want, they covet the office of bishop because of the wealth and power that is associated with that, instead of what it originally began with as a way to oversee the flock. Okay, does that answer your question? Okay. Anything else? Yes. Mary?
I have a question. How do we know the Eastern Christian Church today?
Eastern Orthodox Church?
What name do they have?
It's typically referred to as Eastern Orthodox. I think they do have another designation.
Greek Orthodox.
Yeah, Greek Orthodox, that's another one. But it kind of goes back to what we had last week when we talked about these two schools of thought. The Greek mind and the Latin mind there's always been a distinction there. And we see this even in the early church when there is a universal Catholic faith. But we begin to see that coalesce into these two groups. And over time, not just in areas of theology and doctrine, but also for political reasons, as later on, as we go through church history, we'll find out that then the empire itself is split between East and West. And so the churches begin to do this through time until you come to, I believe it's 1054, and they split. Okay? And they have been, they hold churches throughout Eastern Europe. They're associated with the Russian Orthodox Church. All of that is kind of in that same Eastern tradition, whereas we Protestants are in the Western tradition, coming out of Roman Catholicism. Does that answer your question? Okay. Anything else? Steve, would you close in prayer?